Hello, and welcome to Making Apache Spark, Apache Mahout, Kubernetes, and Kubeflow Play Nice. First of all, thank you for coming to my talk. As is customary among our people, the second slide will be about me and a quick highlight reel of my credentials. My name is Trevor Grant. I'm from the Humboldt Park neighborhood of Chicago. The background image is a skyline taken at sundown at the top of the sledding hill in the park. You get this cool effect where all the buildings light up orange at sundown in December and January. I thought it looked neat, so here we are. First and foremost, I'm the PMC chair of Apache Mahout. While not the second most important thing, a fun fact is I'm also on the project mentorship committee of Apache Streams and Apache Community Development, and I'm a mentor of the Apache SDAP Incubating. All cool projects, please check them out. From all of this Apache activity, you might have guessed I'm also an Apache Software Foundation member. But wait, there's more. I'm author of Kubeflow for Machine Learning from Lab to Production, available from O'Reilly Media. And lastly, since I believe our job shouldn't define us, my side hustle is I'm trying to start importing e-trikes into Chicago. Haven't decided on a name for this venture yet. And finally, I'm Director of Developer Relations at Aricto. And even though my work at Aricto was last, certainly not least, it's a segue into about Aricto. As is also customary among our people, the third slide is about who pays me. The thing to note here is we're hiring developer relations engineers. Imagine getting paid to play with open source, write blogs, and give talks. Please apply. We're specifically looking for candidates in Europe, one in Asia, one on the West Coast of North America, because in Chicago, I'm everything east of the Rockies. I think this is my first pre-recorded conference talk, and I'm admittedly a bit over my skis here. During the lockdown, my interests have migrated into storytelling, and the real benefactors slash victims will be you, the guinea pigs, who will watch this, a technology talk in three acts. In the first act, we'll do some exposition, introduce our characters, set our problem up a bit. In the second act, we'll dive more into the problem. And finally, in the third act, which I hope will be the majority of the talk, we'll talk about how the characters work together to solve the problem. There will be a brief epilogue where we'll discuss some of the results as well as the outcomes of the research. Act 1, exposition. So we will begin with a bit of exposition to introduce our characters and our problem. The characters on this adventure will be Kubernetes, Kubeflow, Apache Spark, and Apache Mahout, a motley crew indeed. Born in different generations to solve similar but different problems. Kubernetes, what is it? Kubernetes is a portable, extensible, open source platform for managing containerized workloads and services that facilitates both declarative configuration and automation. It has a large and rapidly growing ecosystem. Kubernetes service support and tools are widely available. All that directly from their website. Why do we need it? This is my favorite works on my machine meme, but we're not going to be using one machine, e.g. Docker, like the meme. We're going to be using multiple, and Kubernetes keeps track of them for us. So we're just using Kubernetes to make this easily reproducible for others. Design once, run anywhere. Kubernetes is the de facto container orchestration layer. Note, I said de facto, not the only. Works on-prem or any serious cloud, GCP, AWS, Azure, IBM Cloud, DigitalOcean, the list goes on. Note, I am grossly underestimating the power and usefulness of Kubernetes here. I don't want any Kubernetes contributors egging my house. Please, if you're not familiar with Kubernetes, go see other talks, learn about it, get familiar with it. It's an amazing technology. And secondly, we're using Kubernetes because we want to use Kubeflow. What is Kubeflow? Also directly from the project website, the Kubeflow project is dedicated to making deployments of machine learning workflows on Kubernetes simple, portable, and scalable. Our goal is not to recreate other services, but to provide a straightforward way to deploy the best of breed open source systems for ML to diverse infrastructures. Anywhere you are running Kubernetes, you should be able to run Kubeflow. Why do we need it? More succinctly, Kubeflow lets us do all this work, then post our pipeline, and then anyone could reproduce our work by going to fetch the data we used, cloning our notebooks and pipeline, uploading and running their deployment. Or if they want to extend our work, for instance, doing some deep learning at the end, then they do all those steps and just add one more step for whatever magic they want to tack on. Or if they want to use our system to denoise other CT scans, they just need to put said scans in a different directory mimicking the structure of our input data. Or other combinations. The point is, Kubeflow makes it much easier to reproduce research, and there are lots of other talks about why that is important. Grumpy Cat doesn't like to reproduce research, and neither do graduate students, but that's how science works, and also how graduate programs work. I'm just tangentially touching on this, but there's an entire other talk here about why reproducible research is good, why Kubeflow is great for making findings reproducible and extendable, and why people should not only post their code with papers, but also full pipelines, since pre-processing steps are another reason sometimes papers can't be reproduced. Okay, that ends this soapbox, but there will be more, I promise. Apache Spark, what is it? Also from the website, Apache Spark trademark is a multi-language engine for executing data engineering, data science, and machine learning on single node machines or clusters. While still exciting and new, it's a bit more mature of a tech, and since you're lean in technologists, I'm going to assume you have some familiarity here. Why do we need it? The first reason we need it is when we start working with CT scans, they are big, like 500 megabytes. And when we try to do a matrix conversion, which we'll talk about soon, to do so on a single node in NumPy estimated that you need about 500 gigabytes of RAM. Some computers have that now, but it's a harsh requirement. Using Spark lets multiple smaller machines work together, which again, more people have access to and costs less to do work on. And we want this to be easily reproducible by anyone, not just big corporations and universities. But note, we're only using Spark for the layer that lets multiple nodes work together. For the actual matrix math, we'll be using a library called Apache Mahout. From the website, Apache Mahout is a distributed linear algebra framework and mathematically expressive Scala DSL designed to let mathematicians, statisticians, and data scientists implement their own algorithms. You might be thinking, wait, I've heard of Mahout, but I was thinking of something else. I'm confused. Well, I happen to be the PMC chair of the project, one of the many leaders who are stuck making sure the quarterly reports get filed and such. Let me take a moment to clarify. Mahout was the original distributed machine learning library. Machine learning on Hadoop and Mahout are synonymous. But then Hadoop started losing popularity to Spark and wailed on to way. And in 2015, new Mahout was made. This one used Spark as the default backend, introduced a Scala domain-specific language that made it look like R, and that means you could write R-like expressions in your Scala code, which are much easier to read mathematically. But now it's been another half a decade, Scala's popularity is starting to wane, and several of the project's leaders are working on blockchain-related issues, either for fun or as part of our day job. I'm doing it for fun. My day job is Kubeflow. When Mahout started, it was the first and only distributed machine learning library. Now we're just one of a nameless rabble, so we've recently decided to extend the library for doing analytics on blockchain ledgers. For more information or to get involved, join the Apache Mahout mailing list, and there's a note there on how to do that. So why do we need Mahout? While Spark and Spark ML have some built-in functionality for dealing with matrices, they have issues with matrices that won't fit inside a single node. Mahout is much better, has much better support, especially for distributed matrices. Specifically, we're going to need to do a matrix inversion, and I'm purposefully hand-waving here since linear algebra wasn't a prerequirement for this talk, and even if it was, I don't know how to make it interesting yet. The takeaway is, Mahout has a method called distributed stochastic singular value decomposition, which we'll be shortening to DSSVD in the slides for the rest of the talk, and for our project, we needed a DSSVD. The problem our band of heroes will hope to solve will be that of COVID screening. But how? How will our heroes learn to overcome their differences and work together to solve a problem that would be way out of scope for any of them individually? Stay tuned to find out. Dun dun dun. Act 2, the plot thickens. Now you might already be thinking, why would anyone need to do any of this? Just use rapid tests. Let's do a little thought exercise. Close your eyes. You're in a very large and very empty parking lot. You see yourself walking up to a 1982 DMC DeLorean. You walk to the driver's side and open the gull wing. You sit in the driver's seat and punch into the LCD display, March 28th, 2020. You put the DeLorean in drive and start driving. You slowly accelerate, very slowly. Hopefully there's enough parking lot. Once you hit 88 miles per hour, that's about 141 kilometers per hour, You travel through time. Next thing you know, you're driving in an almost identical parking lot, just as large, just as empty, same buildings. But now you're in the year 2020 and you've traveled about 22 months back in time to late March 2020. It's March 2020 and people are dying. In Spain, Italy, New York City's hospitals are being overrun with suspected COVID patients. Also, you can open your eyes now. You're still in March 2020 mindset, but I'm showing headlines as evidence of my point. Note the date here. It's hard to read, but it says March 28th, 2020. Guy is wearing plastic wraps as a cootie shield. It looks silly now, but at the time, it was scary. Real epidemiologists then knew less than the armchair epidemiologists of today know. In March 2020, no one knew what was going on, but people were scared. Not everyone had COVID, and it took a long time to figure out who did and who didn't. As is shown on this piece from NPR, also on March 28th, specifically PCR tests, same test you get today if you get a non-rapid one, took about 3 days to turn the results around. People were trying to come up with rapid tests, but as we see here from March 26th, only detecting 60% of true positives at the time was considered promising. Note, these weren't even widely available yet. They were more like coming soon teasers. This was compounding issues with hospitals being overrun because not everyone who comes to the hospital thinking they have COVID actually has COVID, but people had to sit there for 3 days waiting for tests to come back and possibly getting COVID during that time. Here we see an article from March 23rd. I just discovered this while making this slide deck, but it concisely illustrates a point. Creativity in finding new ways to rapidly detect COVID with equipment already available at the hospital was at a premium. The article refers to doctors at some of the early hotspots, Italy and Spain, using ultrasound to make COVID diagnoses earlier than the 3-day PCR test could come back. Even if just directional, could have a huge impact. This article from Imaging Technology News, admittedly biased, from February 26th, espouses CT scans for rapid COVID detection. Note the bias was calling CT scans the best so early, but there's still some validity here. It's not totally biased. But CT scans have issues. They actually have several issues, but the one we're going to focus on is the radiation dose you get when you get one. A thoracic CT scan, thoracic being your chest region, a thoracic CT scan gives you around 6 to 7 millisieverts of radiation. Here's a chart to put that in perspective. So it's not horrible, but it's also really high for a diagnostic procedure. As you can see in the picture, definitely a mid to high yellow. Another metric to put this in perspective is in your entire life, you're really only supposed to get about a maximum of 400 millisieverts of radiation. So CT scans have been used for a while to diagnose lung cancer, but full dose CT scans were also considered too much radiation for diagnostics in this realm as well. So in and around the late 90s, early aughts, a lower dose method of CT scanning was developed. An entire lecture could be given on the differences between regular CT scans and low dose CT scans, but for our purposes, allow me to hand wave a bit here as well. All CT scans are in essence a series of x-rays which are compiled into a stack of 2D images, which can be rendered in 3 dimensions. Low-dose CT scans use x-rays with significantly less radiation, but the resultant scans are noisier. And here, think of noise like static on a TV with no input. Did you ever try watching a channel when you were a kid that your parents didn't pay for? Or if you had an antenna, a channel that was just a bit too far away? You could squint your eyes and kind of get it, but it wasn't great. My hip shot recreation here isn't really illustrating the problem, but just to give you an idea. Since the advent of, really in parallel with, low-dose CT scans, people have been coming up with ways to denoise them. The main approach is a thing sort of similar to a principal component analysis or PCA for those that learn statistics from sklearndocs. The thing to remember that even low-dose CT scans, the data set is large and cubic, not square. For instance, a 300 by 500, not great resolution, but not horrible. Figure another 500 slices, and you've got a dense matrix that has 75 million data points. PCA uses a singular value decomposition, the part of the PCA that does the matrix inversion. I knew I couldn't do it locally, but just for fun with NumPy, I tried it, and it threw a warning saying I would need 500 gig of RAM. You can get computers now with 500 gig of RAM, but they're pricey, even rent on cloud, and we're wizards of open source, so I'll leave that as a teaser for the next section. So to recap to this point, in March 2020, there was a large need for COVID rapid tests that could utilize existing hospital equipment as opposed to having to be produced and distributed. CT scans were known to be a good tool, but among other things, they deliver high doses of radiation. Low-dose CT scans, a technique that had been around for 20 years, solved the radiation problem but produced noisy images. And through clever use of open source software and renting cloud time, we deliver a quickly and easily reproducible method for denoising CT scans, the details of which we'll go into in our next section. But first, an intermission. Assuming you're not watching this live, feel free to pause, get yourself a drink, etc. Okay, we're back. And now for the dramatic conclusion of our talk. So to recap to this point, it was March 2020. There was a large need for COVID rapid tests that utilized existing hospital equipment. CT scans were known to be a good tool, but among other things, deliver high doses of radiation. Low-dose CT scans, a technique that had been around for 20 years, solved the radiation problem, produced noisy images. Open source software, we think we can denoise these CT scans. And by open source software, I specifically mean how our heroes, Kubeflow, Apache Spark, Apache Mahout, and Kubernetes, will overcome their differences to solve this problem. So we weren't the only one thinking along these lines at the time. Dr. Paiva, a Brazilian radiologist, got CT scans of 10 patients with COVID from Wuhan, China, and posted them to coronacases.org early in the pandemic to help other radiologists detect COVID with radiology. That is, to show them what it looks like. The site is still up. You can go access corona CT scans yourself right now. What does COVID look like in a CT scan? First, let me say very clearly, I'm not a radiologist. I have no formal training in radiology, but from the papers I've read, COVID in a thoracic CT scan presents as ground glass occlusions, and I think that's what we see in the image on the right toward the bottom. So why was it critical to use open source software for this? I doubt I have to sell this in too hard to this audience, but in addition to open source being awesome, one, lots of socioeconomically disadvantaged areas need tests too. In March, we didn't realize how badly sub-Saharan Africa and other poor areas of the world would be left behind. In our headlines as visual aids, we see one from January 2021 from the Wall Street Journal, how COVID-19 has widened the gap between rich and poor countries. Using open source software can level the playing field between rich and poor countries. Free and open source software can be distributed much quicker than proprietary software. I don't have time to soapbox this point out completely, but I trust you understand how, when, and why free and open source software, free and open source software is great. So let me talk about the big picture and what we're going to do. My hope is that when viewed from 10,000 meters, the more intricate details will at best make more sense and at least won't bore you completely to tears. So big picture, what is going to happen here? First, we will collect all of our images into an S3 bucket. Could be any storage device. S3 bucket was easiest at the time. Next, we have a little Python app that reads DICOM images and converts them into numerical matrices and writes them back to disk. Next, we'll load the matrices into Spark as a resilient distributed dataset or an RDD. Then we'll wrap the RDD into a Mahout distributed row matrices or DRM. And then we'll do a distributed stochastic singular value decomposition or DSSVD on the DRM, which yields two new DRMs, which we then write back to disk and can render images with various amounts of denoising applied. S3 buckets aren't exactly open source, but they are kind of the lingua franca in cloud object storage. I know we've been pushing why open source is important, but it's also important that our solution has the ability for others to pick up and use with minimal friction. So that was the S3 bucket reason. So the first step of our pipeline requisitions a persistent volume container, then downloads the DICOM from the S3 bucket into the PVC. I can't emphasize enough what an anti-pattern this is, and candidly, I'm embarrassed that I did it. I'm sure there was a reason, I can't remember it now. Just a note in case you were trying to clone my repo and wondering why in the world, the answer is there probably was a reason, I forgot it. Also as a note, this work is published twice. The why is answered in a peer-reviewed journal article, the how in chapter 9 of a book, which I'll be pushing later. All of the code, as well as the pipeline to deploy this on your own, Kubeflow exists in Git. There's an XCDC comic about a computer science undergrad handing assignments in different languages, and for Python, the professor saying, you can't just import answers. It's pretty applicable to this step. I needed to read DICOM images. That's what CT scans are saved as. So, of course, there exists not one, but multiple libraries to do it. PyDICOM had the easiest on-ramp, so I used it. To do the next bit of magic, we need to convert a DICOM into a numerical matrix. PyDICOM makes that pretty straightforward process, like 15 lines of code straightforward. So we read our DICOM process into it and turned it into a numerical matrix, then dumped the matrix to the PVC. Now that's the second time I've waved my hands and written to a PVC, but what is a PVC? A PVC is a persistent volume claim. And for those who don't know what that is, if you recall, Kubernetes is just a layer that orchestrates a bunch of Docker containers. A PVC gives you a volume you can mount to various containers. And as such, you can treat it like some persistent disk space for handing large files off between containers, or more precisely, steps in our pipeline. For instance, the first step was to requisition a PVC and download a DICOM to it. The next step, where we are now, was to process the DICOM into a numerical matrix and write the matrix back to the PVC. Our next step will be to read that matrix into an Apache Spark into an RDD. Now, I'm making it seem like running Spark on Kubernetes is just another trivial step. Let me be clear, it's not. It's not super difficult, but it's also not super simple. If steps in our pipeline are just Docker containers, then how do we run a Spark job, which might have a variable number of workers operating across multiple nodes? In short, it requires a resource op, and candidly, I'm a bit nervous to go too into detail on this. It worked back in 2020, but Kubeflow has been fast evolving ecosystem, and I haven't run it to make sure that it works on the new Kubeflow releases, nor have I confirmed that this is still the right way to do this, presuming it still works. But let us suspend disbelief and assume it is still the right way. You define a resource op with a manifest, like so many things in Kubernetes, and in the manifest, you specify how many workers you'll use and how big each worker should be. The step is important, and it's what separates a real-world Spark job on Kubernetes from a proof of concept where you fool yourself into thinking at scale when it won't. You can kind of hack Spark into working with just a driver and a Docker container, but at that point, why are you using Spark? And while it might give you a word count under any serious load, will blow up with an out-of-memory error. Speaking of out-of-memory errors, if you thought error tracing on Spark was bad before Spark jobs distributed on Kubernetes will be a special new layer of hell for you. So, fun. Also, we're running Mahout on top of Spark, so we must wrap our RDD in a distributed row matrix. And this whole project really didn't turn out into the Mahout time to shine I'd hoped. Mahout only counts for about 7 lines of code. 1 to wrap the RDD, 3 to set some parameters, 1 to execute the DSSVD, and 3 to write the output. So allow me to do some hand-waving here as getting into what a singular value decomposition is and how it works is easily a week of lectures in a college-level advanced linear algebra class. And then this isn't even a full-on SVD, but a distributed stochastic singular value decomposition, which was the subject of a doctoral thesis by Nathan Halko, whom I owe a beer should I ever meet him, because this technique has powered several of my talks now. So Dr. Halko, if you're watching, first, thank you. Second, let's get a beer. So a singular value decomposition will take a matrix, spit out 2 other matrices and a vector of singular values. Now, before your eyes glaze over, the 2 matrices will be, you know what? You're all at home. Supposing you're not watching this live, just go Google a video on SVD or eigenfaces. Or if you are watching live, you know what a PCA is, or have you at least heard of it? What this denoising technique in essence boils down to is doing a PCA on an image. And the idea is the vectors we drop off at the end will be the noise vectors. Now that's a gross oversimplification, but for us open source enthusiasts, it's close enough given our time constraints. So we're going to do a PCA and just trim off the noise vectors at the end. Too easy, right? Couple of side questions on the side. Why not use NumPy? I think I mentioned earlier, I tried it just to see what would happen. It estimated 500 gig of RAM was needed to do non-distributed, non-stochastic singular value decomposition, which exceeds the specs of my desktop or anything I saw for rent on the cloud at the time. Why not use Spark's built-in linear algebra package? Well, Spark ML focuses more on machine learning. The SVD method is not distributed and it's not stochastic, which will limit it to only running in one node, which gives us the same issues as NumPy. Finally, what does the image have to do with anything? I don't know, but I found it on Towards Data Science. So I guess data science is turning back into statistics, and this image looks a lot cooler than my advanced linear algebra notes. So here we see some results from the paper we published on the topic. Let me be candid and say it is unclear but unlikely that the originals were low-dose CT scans. However, we can see how images degrade if we denoise them too much. There is information at the bottom about how we recombine them. The recombination is a straightforward matrix multiplication and could easily be done in a web browser with JavaScript, though I think I use Python. It's typical noise and signal problem. We are doing this method to remove noise, but we can see from D, if you remove too much noise, you start to lose signal. So this just about concludes my talk on multiple open source projects and advanced mathematics to try to do some good in the world, which I have presented without a single line of code or mathematical formula. Ta-da! But wait, there's more. An epilogue. Before we published, rapid tests became cheaply and widely available, which overall is a good thing. If I had to rank the things happening in the 2020s, I'd say our book coming out was the best thing, followed by rapid tests becoming cheaply and widely available, and way down at the bottom, Zoom happy hours, which was a trend I was not sad to see die off. That said, go to Google Scholar and search CT scans COVID. There's still a lot of research being published every day about this. I know because Google thinks this is my specialty, so it emails me about it all the time too. I would really like to give this full talk too. I told some jokes in the first act about it, but in all seriousness, having reproducible examples is critical to modern science. And from grad school, I remember it's not always an easy thing to do. In addition to researchers not clearly defining their algorithm, not publishing data, or other inherent problems, they will often totally gloss over what data prep steps they took, which is a huge, if not the most important part of doing any analysis. This talk has a few calls to action. One of them is for researchers to help enlarge the body of knowledge by publishing not only data and code, but full pipelines. I touched on this earlier, using Spark on Kubernetes, you can trick yourself into thinking something will work when instead of really deploying cluster, you're just deploying in driver node. But this whole thing is a good example of how to use Spark with Kubeflow. The code for all this, and yes, there was code, I just militantly don't show it in my talk, can be found here. But why use code when you can buy my book and read and cite my article? Now, there was probably something I agreed about not pitching commercial products when I signed up for this talk, but I didn't read it that close. So get ready to be aggressively pitched a commercial product. The book some friends and I wrote about Kubeflow. My tagline for this contemporary masterpiece of Western literature was enchant your friends and enrage your enemies, but O'Reilly Media decided to go with from lab to production, which is also okay, I guess. Fun fact, as I mentioned earlier, the how-to of this book is chapter 9, and that is actually how I built the pipeline for denoising CT scans. Another fun fact, the why is published in a peer-reviewed journal at the link above. Another important point, and hopefully I don't get hissed off the stage for saying it, we used open source so it could be almost zero cost and require November, but Kubeflow can be a complicated bear to get set up and working right. I would seriously consider some vendor-managed solution. I don't mean this as a pitch for my company or even just for Kubeflow. Just a note, you have to realize your time has value, and how much of it do you want to spend just getting to Hello World?